have a quorum, so we're going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. My name is John Cabot, and I serve as the chair for the Northern Region, and I represent the non-consumptive from Hooper. We're going to go ahead and introduce ourselves, and Matt, why don't you go ahead and start?
Yeah, Matt Clark from Ogden. I'm at large.
Paul Chase, representing the Forest Service.
Justin Oliver, West Haven, Utah, at large.
Mike Lauder, Sportsman's Rep, Hooper.
Kevin McLeod, West Haven, at large.
Craig Van Tassel, Camas, Sportsman.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden, Public at Large.
John Wall, Riverdale, Public at Large.
Chad Jensen, Logan, elected.
Kristen Purdy, Ogden, non-consumptive.
Bryce Thurgood Perry, at large.
And Justin Doling, I'm the regional supervisor and serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
Okay, if you can join me in turning off the ringers on your cell phone so we can have an uninterrupted meeting tonight, that would be appreciated. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management, policy, rules, and regulations. The council then makes those recommendations to the Wildlife Board. And the Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the five different regional advisory councils for all protected species in Utah. I'd like to welcome tonight also our Wildlife Board representative, Byron Bateman, who's here tonight. Thanks for joining us. This meeting will be recorded for a transcription of the minutes, and the audio recording and minutes will be available on the DWR website. When you speak tonight, we ask that you please come up and use the microphone so that we can have a good record of that. If we go ahead and turn to the agenda for tonight's meeting, I'll make note that the falconry rule amendment recommendations have been removed from the agenda tonight, and those will be considered at a later time. That was the only change from the circulated agenda that was put forth. If there's no objection, we will go ahead and approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. Seeing no objection, the agenda for tonight's meeting is approved. Everyone should have received a circulation of the minutes from the previous meeting. And are there any corrections to those minutes? There being no objection, then the minutes are approved as circulated. The next business in order is the regional update.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome out to the Northern Region Advisory Council meeting. Just wanted to give you a brief update on the Northern Region activities that have been going on and will be going on for the next month or so. And I'll just go through and recap each one of our sections. In our wildlife section, they're still continuing to do deer classifications, so I'd encourage RAC members, if they have an interest in going out and joining a biologist, either make contact with the biologist or you can contact me directly. They are gearing up for trapping turkeys in Eden, Manaway, Paradise, Bountiful, and those turkeys are targeted to be moved out to the Book Cliffs. So that's a good effort, and we've got some city turkey issues that we need to deal with here, and that's a good place for those birds to go. And then they will be radio collaring deer on the cache for part of that deer survival study that we use when we model our deer populations. So that'll be going on shortly as well. In our law enforcement section, this Saturday they'll have a shop with a cop day, and then they've been participating in a fundraiser to purchase camel coats for needy kids, and they raised about $4,000 to purchase coats, and so that was a great effort. In our outreach section, opening day for Hardware Ranch is on December 10th. You're all welcome to come up, and they will be holding an ice fishing clinic on December 10th as well at the Cabela's in Farmington from 11 to 3. In our Great Salt Lake Ecosystem project, the waterfowl area has had a great pheasant hunt. They just had a lot of participation, a lot of success. There's still plenty of swans on the marshes. The season's getting really close. I don't know, Blair, it's probably still open, but it's right at near the end, right? Okay. They have measured the harvest of over 27 million pounds of brine shrimp eggs on the Great Salt Lake, and that's a wet weight measurement. Right now, the cyst count per liter is really high, so there's still opportunity for the brine shrimpers to continue to harvest, and so they anticipate that harvest will go through at least the end of December. And then the new waterfowl wetland unit at Farmington Bay that's been under construction this fall is really close to nearing completion. I guess gravel will be hauled out on the roadways here shortly. In our habitat section, they've been working to reseed a couple of our big fires we've had here in the region. And in aquatics, they wanted to mention that our Bear Lake whitefish spawn is currently occurring at Bear Lake. It's a great time to go up and catch whitefish. It's kind of an underutilized resource, and would encourage you to maybe take that up and go up, see if you can't catch one of those big whitefish. And then, excuse me, the guys also indicated that they were able to analyze some of the boreal toad data this fall, and they've had three toads in West Box Elder County that have traveled between 1 and 3 miles across dry desert land. So those are impressive movements for a little animal about the size of a cell phone. So that's all I have unless there's questions.
Kevin.
Justin, what effect would the breach of the causeway have on the brine shrimping? Will it be any effect at all?
Yeah, that's a good point. I probably should mention that the railroad, December 1st, they had installed a new bridge, but they had earthen fill on either side. And so on December 1st, they opened that up. And we had worked with the railroad to try to delay that until December so that it wouldn't have an impact on the brine shrimp production. The fear was that the south arm is about 3.5 feet higher than the north arm, and as that water was allowed to rush into the north arm, it would push heavy brines back into the south and possibly cause mortality on the shrimp and impact not only the brine shrimp season, but also impact the eared grebes that come in and molt, become flightless during that time of the year, impact their resource on the Great Salt Lake. So that was open December 1st, and already the south arm has dropped probably about 0.2 foot, and the north arm has raised about 0.3 foot. And when I talk about the north arm, I'm talking about Promontory West. So it doesn't include Bear River Bay. That's considered part of the south arm.
Any other questions for Justin? We had a RAC member join us. You want to go ahead and introduce yourself before we continue?
Sure. Sorry, I'm late. Matt Preston from the BLM.
Great. Thank you. So the standard operating procedure for tonight's meeting will be as follows. We will have a representative from the DWR make a presentation on the agenda item. Then we will have questions from the public regarding the agenda item. We will move to the RAC for questions and then back to the public for comment. If you are representing yourself, we will give you a 3-minute time period to make your comments. If you are representing an organized group, you'll be allowed 5 minutes. In either case, we ask that you fill out a blue comment card if you wish to address the agenda item so that we have record of your comment. After the public comment period, we'll move back to the RAC, and the RAC will have an opportunity to comment on the agenda item and then make any motions necessary for the item. Council members, I'll remind you that if you wish to abstain regarding a particular agenda item, that you provide a reasoning for that so we can have that for the record as well. Okay, so we will go ahead and move to our first agenda item. That's the waterfowl recommendation and rule amendments for 2017 presented by Blair Stream.
All right, thank you, Mr. Is it even on?
Doesn't sound.
Okay, perfect. All right, so I'll be presenting the 2017-18 waterfowl recommendations tonight. And as I get into those, I wanted to first just update you on the conditions for most of the major breeding areas in North America. So things were similar this year as they were last year. For the most part, we've had probably good to very good conditions across most of the breeding areas. A lot of our birds come from Alaska, as well as kind of that corner where Montana, Alberta, and Saskatchewan come together. That particular area was a little bit drier this year than it was in the past. They had a lot of fires, and so some of the birds that, or lack of birds that we may have seen that this fall may have been attributed to that, but overall across most of the breeding areas, we did have fairly favorable breeding conditions for most of the waterfowl species in North America. How that translates into our waterfowl populations, for ducks, we're still sitting pretty close to record highs. This last year, we were a little bit lower than we were in 2015, but for the most part, you know, we're still sitting right up there around 50 million ducks. Looking at some of the specific species, for the most part, most species were similar to what they were last year. We did see a few increases in things like widgeon and scop, and then we did see some larger decreases in shovelers. And pintail is probably the most significant decrease. They did go down quite a bit this last year. And overall, compared to their long-term average, they have been down quite significantly for a number of years now. And the way that our waterfowl packages are put together, it's based largely on the western population of mallards. So everything in the Pacific Flyway. Given that our mallard population was very robust again this last spring, we've been offered the liberal package. That would give us a 107-day season and a bag of seven birds. Everything as far as our species-specific species that have specific harvest strategies associated with them, those are pintails, camelsback, and scoff, will be the same as last year. Except for pintails, we have specific thresholds that if a bird drops below, we have to reduce the season length or the bag limit. And unfortunately, pintails did drop below one of these thresholds this last year. And so the highest number we can have is one pintail in the bag limit this year. I mean, so that's what the Fish and Wildlife Service has offered us, and so we will go with that one pintail this year. Looking at some of the other bird species in the Pacific Flyway, our population of swans continues to be very strong. We've averaged about 80 to 90,000 birds over the last 30 or 40 years now. Our Canada goose population continues to increase both locally and across the Pacific Flyway, as well as our light geese, our snow and Ross geese. They continue to increase all across the Pacific Flyway as well. So getting into the recommendation portion, one of the changes we looked at this year was creating a duck zone in the southern part of the state. It's been probably 10 or 15 years since we've had a southern duck zone. There has been a lot of interest from waterfowl hunters down in that portion of the state to put this zone back in place. There are many reasons why this may be a good opportunity for hunters, and so as we looked at this, we found that it probably is a lot of hunting opportunity that could be gained by creating a southern duck zone. By doing so, it would allow for longer seasons to hunt ducks in the state. Currently, we're restricted to 107 days. By putting an extra season or extra zone in place, it would allow us to start a season later in the southern part of the state and have longer duck season overall. It would also allow us to have two openers and two youth days in the state. And there's been a lot of interest from people to try to have more opportunity for youth. So this would give us an opening day in the northern and southern part of the state, as well as a youth day in the northern and southern part of the state. One of the trends we've also seen over the last probably 5 years or so is that the warmer weather has reduced the number of birds in the southern part of the state earlier in the year. Some of our waterfowl management areas have only had a duck or two harvested on opening weekend. It's been relatively slow the first couple weeks, and so by having a southern zone, it would allow us to start the season later. They'd have more birds down there. They could also capitalize on some of the late hunting opportunities down later in the season when there are generally more dirt birds in the southern part of the state. And lastly, there has been a growing interest in many of our diver hunters to have more opportunities to hunt scop later in the season. So we could also provide a later scop hunt for hunters by having a second zone. So the proposed zone would be similar to what we had 10 or 15 years ago. The northern part of the state would be seen here in the white, so pretty much everything north of I-80 across Tooele County, and then the southern edge of Utah County, Uinta and Duchesne County. Everything south of there would be included in the southern zone. And so how the dates would shake out for these two zones, the northern zone would start, as always, on the first Saturday in October. So next year that would be October 17th, and it would run until January 20th. For the southern part of the state, that would start on October 14th and run until January 27th. For our scop season dates, those would in the north would start on October 7th and run until December 31st, given that we only have 86 days for scop. The southern part of the state would start on November 3rd and run it till the very end of the season, which would be January 27th. For bag limits, they'd be the same as they were last year, except for the pintail, which would be reduced to one pintail. And the coot, snipe, and falconry bags would all be the same. Now for our goose zones, they'd also largely stay the same as they have been. Our eastern Boxilla County zone, which is the Corinne area, would stay the same season dates. The Wasatch Front Zone, or which we refer to as the urban zone, would still stay the same as well. We would have to modify the northern zone, so it would essentially be along that boundary that we created for the southern duck zone. That would have the similar season dates that we've had in the past. And then the southern zone, we would actually be able to do away with the split in that area, so it would start on the day the duck hunt starts and end on the day the goose hunt and or duck hunt ends. For light geese, we're keeping those dates similar to what we had last year as well. And we typically see some birds move through about the middle of October till about the end of November. But the vast majority of our geese, light geese, tend to come through in the spring. So we put the majority of our 107 days in the latter part of the hunt. We're hunting until March 10th, which is the last day we can legally hunt under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. We are recommending one closure as well in Millard County to accommodate the light goose or snow goose festival that occurs in Delta each year, and that would be closed from February 5th through February 28th, and that would be only for Millard County. Our swan season, it would be similar dates as well as we have had in the past, restricted specifically to the Great Salt Lake Hunt area, and permits would be 2,000 permits. And lastly, our youth day, because we are able to offer two youth days, the first one for the northern part of the state would occur on September 23rd, and then the next one would be in the south part of the state on September 30th. That would be available for youth 17 or younger on July 31st. And anybody, they would have to have a mentor with them as well, and anyone who's over 15 would also be required to have a duck stamp. One other recommendation we are proposing tonight is to create a rest area at Ogden Bay. The majority of our waterfowl management areas do have dedicated rest areas, and typically these provide a place for birds to come and rest and loaf during the day, and then they move out of this rest area back and forth into huntable areas throughout the day. Generally, it provides a lot better hunting opportunity. And so this rest area at Ogden Bay is going to be directly west of the headquarters area. It's about 250 acres, and we would be recommending that to be blocked off as a specific rest area with no access for hunting or even walking or anything like that, similar to what we do on all of our other rest areas. The other changes we're making in rule, currently we have defined the Farring Bay Learning Center. You can shoot outside of 600 feet from that specific center, and we'd like to designate a whole specific area as being a learning center area and not allow any discharge of firearms within that area. We're also making some changes to our swan application. We currently don't allow youth hunters to apply as a group in our swan drawing, so we'd like to make that change. And we're also holding back 1% of our swan permits each year in the drawing. This was implemented back quite a while ago, before we had a preference point system. It was put in place in case we had any errors in the drawing because we can't exceed 2,000 permits. So this was a way that we could offer all of our permits, and if there were any errors, we could modify those and offer the permits out after the drawing occurs. We currently do have a preference point system now, and so it's not necessary to hold back 1% of the permits as we do the swan drawing. So we're looking to do away with that language. And also we just need to redefine the definition of youth for our swan and crane drawings. Currently it's still 15 or younger, and we'd like to change that to the 17 or younger definition that we have in other parts of our rule for waterfowl. And those are all the changes I have, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thank you, Blair. Do we have any questions from the public regarding the presentation? If you'd like to come up and state your name and then make your question at the microphone.
Carl Stetler. Blair, is that rest area on Ogden Bay going to be the same place it used to be?
It's not. It's in a little bit different area. I don't know, Rich, do you want to describe exactly where it is? Were you looking for just kind of specifically where it's at? Or?
Well, it used to be right behind.
Yeah, so it's currently going to be the road as you come into Ogden Bay. up to where the Unit 3 road goes to the west. It follows that road all the way across to where you come to that dike, a couple hundred yards down that road, and then go south. I believe it was referred to as the Bachman unit.
I'm Rich Hansen. I'm the manager out there. So yeah, it's the North Bachman unit, North Bachman area. So it's the first two impoundments as you head west down the road. It used to be all of Unit 3 when there used to be a rest area out there. So this is just a 250-acre portion of it. I didn't want to take away all the opportunity that Unit 3 provides, but this is a nice centrally located area that right now it's monotypic stanophragmites. We sprayed it this fall. We'll go in and remove all that and open it up, and I think it's going to be perfect for a rest area out there.
Any other questions? If not, we'll proceed to the rack for questions for Blair. Any questions on the presentation? Okay, I don't have any. Okay, I do. We have a comment from Carl Stettler, if you want to go ahead and.
Carl Stettler from the Bear River Club. I just wanted to commend the direction these younger generations of waterfowl managers and biologists are heading. Rest areas like this, essential. Our club, we have 50% of the 13,000 acres is a rest area. If we're going to lose a pintail for a season or two, it's for the greater good of the pintail production. That's what management's all about. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is not going to give us bad data. The rezoning of the dark geese for longer seasons, the extensions of the light goose season, the request for a split season to lengthen the hunting opportunity for southern Utah. The two youth days are all great additions to better the waterfowl hunting opportunities in this state. This season, not counting youth day, March 1st to, or October 1st to March 10th. I can never remember it being that long before. The only concern that I have, and there are two practices that are overlooked each year, the week that is skipped between Youth Day and the general opener is a total waste of primetime duck migration. September 30th is only one day earlier of the opener that we had this season, but it accounts for a seven-day loss of hunter opportunity. Why are not using the better weather and the greater bird numbers compared to the January 15 cold weather and low bird numbers? The reopening of the Swan border to include all properties north of Forest Street, including hunting clubs, public shooting grounds, Salt Creek, and stop the practice of limiting all the swan hunters to pack into the refuge until the parking lots are full. This border needs to be abolished for more hunting opportunities and stop the overcrowding. Use the state waterfowl management areas for the purpose they were created. Your picture you're showing there was showing all of the improvements you've done, but you're skipping two of the big ones. I just want to know why. Because we can actually hunt. We're skipping that one week, and you know how important that week is. There's a lot of cinnamon teal here. Is there a reason why we don't shoot that week?
Yeah, we've typically just opened the waterfowl hunter on the 1st of October for many years now, and so probably the biggest thing is just it's been a tradition in Utah to do that.
But tradition, every one of your hunting dates now has changed. You've changed every single one of them. From the youth day, you've moved it a week ahead. The snow goose season, move it back. You've changed every single hunting date, but you don't change the general opener, and you waste that good week of hunting, of warm weather when all kids can go hunt. Yeah. Everybody can hunt that one week, unless they have a special elk tag, I guess. Yeah. So I just wondering if there was any reason besides it's traditional.
Really, we've never even considered it just because that has been that week, but it's definitely something we could look at and start thinking more about.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Can I just ask a question on a comment to that one? Is the rule say there's 107 hunting days in a duck season?
Yeah, so for all migratory birds, they only offer 107 days.
So if that day was to get moved, we'd lose it on the back end in January.
Yeah.
Troy Justinson.
Troy Justice in Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to commend Blair and the division for the work they've done on the waterfowl season. It's pretty exciting. You know, for the last month, I've had my boys out hunting ducks. There's a lot of birds here. And it's exciting to see the changes to get more people involved, especially youth. So we support the recommendation as presented by the division. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I have no more comment cards, so we'll move to the rack for comments and or motion.
I just have a quick question. So in regards to this gentleman's comment about shooting that first week, if you did that, that would make the opener for the adults or over 17 basically a Sunday start, right? So is that that's the reason for the week in between?
Yes. Yeah,
that's
so
a question. I'm sorry if it sounded like a comment. That was just something that was a thought that we had.
No, you're fine. So typically the Fish and Wildlife Service offers essentially two things when you're structuring a season. They offer a special youth day, which has to be essentially a couple weeks before the opening season can actually start. And so they allow us to start the opening season of the duck hunt from usually the last Saturday in September all the way through about the last Saturday of January. So we can essentially pick 107 days anywhere within that time frame. And then one of those days is taken up by the youth hunt. So it's something that we could always do. I mean, we could always move the seasons up. One thing that has been popular with people is having 2 weeks between the youth hunt and the opener. And so if we were to do that, I'd have to look and see. I don't know if we could potentially accommodate a two-week period between those two. But
my question was just to kind of, I guess, clarify this gentleman's question. If you had that opening day as a youth day and then you started hunting, you'd have to start the opener on a Sunday. Is that correct?
Not necessarily.
To take advantage of that week between the two is what I think, if I understand you correctly, is that right? You
yes.
want to use that week?
No, there's another Saturday that's skipped.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That's what I was. That's where I was lost.
Yeah. So we could technically start it, like the youth day right here starts on September 23rd, and we could start the waterfowl hunt on September 30th.
Okay. So.
Any comments from the RAC and or motion? Matt?
I'll motion that we accept the proposal.
We have a second. John Lauer. Okay, so the motion on the table is to accept the item as presented. Any comment on the motion?
I would entertain adding a... can't think of the word. to amend it. So that it would start on September 30th, the general hunt, a week earlier.
Okay, so we have a subsidiary motion to amend, to start, I'm sorry, what did you say, Craig?
To move the general opening a week earlier and end a week earlier in January. To start it on September 30th. Make a recommendation to the state board. To the Wildlife Board that.
Okay. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, second. Discussion on that motion, amendment? Matt?
Do we have any data on how popular that idea might be with the duck hunters themselves?
I don't believe we've ever even asked duck hunters. It's something that, not to my knowledge, I've heard it from a few people, but not really ever kind of survey or anything like that.
Is that possible that we could, if we didn't act on that tonight, that we could do that survey so next time, I mean, that's kind of a big change that, we'd make, that it would be nice to know some survey before we jumped on it.
Yeah, I guess, in my opinion, I'd probably recommend making it an action item. You can take it to the board, and if that's something they want to approve, we could definitely look into it and go through, a survey like we did for the Northern Goose Zone and get some feedback and then come together probably next year with a recommendation based on that feedback.
Mike?
Blair, this is just a question, for clarification. The gap between the youth day and the opening day is to allow the ducks to settle down and to provide a quality opening day for adult hunters, correct? Is that some of the theory behind it? So that, I mean, if we open it up early, What I don't want to do as a sportsman's rep is not not have it be a quality opening for the adult hunters as well. And so yeah. The gap in between I'm comfortable with. Now I understand the.
Yeah,
that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, no, and I totally understand that. It's largely been based upon just what the public has wanted. We've done it both ways before, and there's a perception that it does impact the opener. What our survey data from our bag checks has shown is that basically there's no difference at all. So it's largely just been something we've maintained just because that's what hunters like, is having a two-week break between. So.
Any other comment from the RAC regarding that subsidiary motion? Okay, seeing none, then we will go ahead and vote on Craig's motion, which is to move the general to the start of the general season to the start on September 30th. Okay? And then we will come back and vote on the other motion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand. Four in favor, opposed? Eight against? So the motion fails. So now we are on to the motion to approve as presented. Do we have any comment regarding that particular motion? Bryce?
I just make a comment that, you know, after we vote on the motion that we do, you know, but look at having the board, you know, look into this and do a survey. I mean, everything we do, every big decision we make, and this is kind of a big one, I think, for waterfowlers, you know, is just something, you know, survey, take some general samples. So we're making an informed decision. So.
Okay, so that'll appear in the minutes for the board, and Byron's here, and hopefully he can express the concern of the Northern RAC about that. Any other comments? Okay, we'll go ahead and call the motion to a vote. So the motion on the table is to approve the recommendation as presented by the DWR. All those in favor indicate by saying aye. Raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries unanimous. Thank you. Next. I'm sorry, we were in the comment section. Next item in order is the 2017 Black Bear Recommendation and Rule Amendments, presented by Rusty Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rusty Robinson. I'm the statewide bighorn and mountain goat biologist, which makes no sense. But we're currently going under we're going through a personnel change in our mammals coordinator position, and in the interim, I've been asked to help out with the bear recommendations. So here I am. I'm happy to be here. I'll try to answer your questions the best I can, but please forgive me if I defer to our regional staff on a lot of these, since I don't know a lot of the history behind this program. Current status of black bears in the state. Our statewide population, according to our population modeling, is still growing, currently growing at approximately 4% annually, but it is a gradual slowing trend. And that data is based on our harvest and age and denning data and all that kind of stuff. Harvest and evaluation over the last 3 years, 2014, we were at 50% statewide success rate on bear harvest, 47% in 2015, and this year we're currently at 40%. However, some of these late fall hunts, those numbers are still coming in, and we're still compiling data. So that number will go up a little bit. And those are the overall sport harvest numbers for the last 3 years. Over the last 25 years, we've steadily increased bear permits in the state. Right alongside that, we've steadily increased our total harvest. Depredation and nuisance-related mortalities were typically around 50 individuals on average. We've had some peaks and valleys there in the last 10 years, but we're currently, this year was kind of, on average, we're right at 48. The way our black bear management system works, our plan was written in 2011. It's a 12-year plan. And the way the system is set up is each unit is assigned one of three harvest strategies, either light, which it comprises 17% of all our black bear units, a moderate harvest strategy, which is 57% of our units, or a liberal strategy, and that's 26% of our units. And under those strategies, we have performance targets that we look at, either percentage of adult males in the harvest or percentage of females in the harvest. So based on the strategy and where our harvest was over a three-year average in relation to those performance targets, we can either remain stable or adjust up to 20% up or down, or if we're exceeding performance targets in the same direction, we can adjust 20 to 40% up or down. And if we decide to change harvest strategies from a light to a moderate or moderate back to light, we can adjust up to 50%. So that's how those numbers are created. We currently offer several types of bear hunts in the state. We have a spring limited entry hunt, which is hounds only, no bait. We have a summer limited entry hunt, which is bait or spot and stock, no hounds, and that has a two-week preseason baiting period. We have a fall limited entry hunt, and under that umbrella we have a few different options. There's a two-week preseason baiting period, but on the La Salles and San Juans there's a no-dog period from September 16th to November 25th. And on the Book Cliffs, there's an archery-only fall limited entry season where bait is allowed but dogs are not. We also offer spot and stock limited entry hunts that are no hounds and no bait. And those are on the Book Cliffs, La Salles, and the San Juans. We also offer multi-season limited entry hunts. These are multiple dates that are specific to the unit. Again, there's a two-week preseason baiting period on that. And we offer harvest objective hunts where unlimited permits are sold, but once the harvest objective or the quota is met, then that season ends. Moving on to regional recommendations. In the northeastern region, we're recommending no change this year in bear permits. Likewise, in the northern region, we're recommending no change. The central region, we're recommending a 5-permit increase on the Central Mountains Nebo unit. And this is a unit that historically, for the last 5 years, has been at 21 permits. We believe our bear density's gone up quite a bit. We're starting to have bears run around Spanish Fork and felt there was time to increase that a little bit. In the southeastern region, this is where the bulk of our changes are being recommended. We're increasing a 10-permit increase on the Central Mountains Manti South San Rafael North unit. And this is largely to address livestock depredation issues. We're killing a lot of bears up there due to depredation, and we just as soon have hunters have that opportunity. The La Salle and San Juan units, we're recommending a 15-permit increase on both of those units. Both those units were exceeding performance targets in both categories, both adult males and percent females. Same with the 9 mile, exceeding performance targets in both categories. And we're recommending it's a 2-permit increase and a 2-quota increase. So the quota will go from 18 to 20, and then the 2 permits will be added on the summer limited entry season from 6 to 8. We're also recommending a boundary change in the southeastern unit. This is just a bit of housekeeping, really, to match our boundary shapes of other species. And so if you can see there, the old versus the new, it's the northern tip of the unit by Moab. Again, it's just to match up with other species, and it probably won't affect bear harvest. And since the La Salle unit borders that, we'd have to change that as well. Again, just that little corner there. In the southern region, we're recommending a 2-permit decrease on the beaver unit. We're also recommending a new hunt there, or a new aspect of the hunt. We're adding the multi-season aspect of it, the 2 permits on the multi-season. One permit increase on the Dutton, one permit increase on Panguitch Lake Zion unit, and a one permit decrease on the Ponsagon. And these might seem like token changes, but when you're dealing with these units with six permits, you know, 20% change is, that's what it is. So, general pursuit season, those are the dates we're recommending, a spring pursuit season of April 1st to June 2nd, summer season of July 5th to August 6th, and a fall season of October 28th to November 16th. Restricted pursuit seasons, we're recommending no change in permits, and the early dates would be July 5th to July 19th, and the late summer dates, July 25th to August 6th. In summary, we're recommending a total of 759 bear permits statewide, which is an increase of 46 permits. 16 of those will be on the spring limited entry hunts, 14 on summer limited entry, 11 on fall limited entry, and 5 on multi-season hunts. We're also recommending an increase in harvest objective quota on the 9-mile unit of 2, boundary changes for the San Juan and LaSalle bear units, and a new aspect to the beaver hunt, which would be the beaver multi-season hunt. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the public regarding the presentation? Questions from the RAC? Russ?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Do you have any data on how that spot stock hunt is going, kind of success?
It's pretty low success rates, yeah. Some of our hunts are in single digits. The good ones are, you know, like 12%, so it's pretty low success.
Yeah, I got firsthand knowledge.
pretty tough, isn't it?
Of that. Yes, it was quite surprising to find out. I hunted the LaSalle spot and stock, and I was excited when I drew the tag until I realized just how many guys were on the mountain, and then was surprised to, in the past, you know, you're there during the muzzleload, a little bit of deer, and you're there during some of the other hunts, and every person I went up to hoping that it was a deer hunter that had ran into a bear was a bear hunter, and if they happened to see a deer, they were going to shoot it. And so my question is, as far as, and I may have missed it, but what the majority of the, for instance, on the LaSalle's, when you increased by 15 permits, were they all in the spot and stock, or what was the division on those?
No, there was no increase in the spot and stock. What it is I think 4 of those are on the spring hunt, 5 on the summer, 5 on the fall, and 1 on the multi-season. And same numbers for the San Juan.
Kevin. Just out of curiosity, you talked about the predation on livestock in a particular unit. Do you have any numbers? I mean, I find it hard to believe that bears are killing a lot of cows.
No, mostly sheep.
Sheep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but well, we do have those numbers. If you've got
a
specific unit in mind, we can address that for you.
Okay. So.
Any other questions?
Rusty, what's behind the 1 week of no dogs in the LaSalle's and the San Juan's?
I believe that's a, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but that's a, you know, where we've got other hunts going on, trying not to run dogs on top of people that are, they're hunting other species. And so it's just kind of a break area where we're not having a lot of conflicts.
Right. Thank you.
Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, we'll move to the comments then from the public. We have Troy.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chairman, we support the division's recommendations on the bears. Thank you.
Mr. Selman.
I'm Brett Selman with the Utah Wool Growers, and we support your recommendations. We appreciate the hunting opportunities increased and the bear numbers increased. We continue to have substantial losses from the wool growers in the state, and we appreciate you all working with us. Thanks.
Thank you. Mitch Herzog.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mitch Herzog, representing the Utah Houndsman Association tonight. We support the recommendations, except a few concerns and things that we sent out a letter, and I'm going to read that right now. As preparations are made for the 2017 Bear Rack Wildlife Board, the Utah Houndsman Association would like to make the following recommendations. The Book Cliffs Bitter Creek Fall Limited Entry Hunt Season be changed to match the LaSalle and San Juan hunt dates. This season was moved to October several years ago. Since that change, this hunt has been at the same time as the general season spike elk hunt. Many hound hunters who have drawn this tag have reported that there are so many hunters in the field at this time, and the potential of conflict was so great that they had to decide not to hunt with their hounds. This is a premium black bear unit, and it takes many years to draw this tag. We feel the potential for conflict is much reduced by moving the season date back to match those other premium units. And the number two, the black bear population and cub production on Book Cliff Bitter Creek unit based on hunter observation appears to be lower the past few years, and we would urge you to conservative in harvest recommendations. And the third, the LaSalle limited entry summer pursuit season allocation be raised to match the San Juan limited entry summer pursuit tag allocation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Moving to the rack for comment.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, if I could make one comment. I failed to acknowledge a mistake I sent out in the rack packet on the hunt tables on the back page, the multi-season hunts on the book cliffs, and thanks for reminding me. I believe in the rack packet we said that the last date on there is October 3rd through November 16th. It actually should be October 2nd. So I've corrected that in this packet, but it wasn't with the packet that went out.
Okay. Thank you. Any comments and or motion from the rack? Matt?
Can you speak to this gentleman's comment about the hunt conflict?
I'd be happy to. That's a, like, and you know the history better than I do, but that was a change that was made a while back. I know the Northeastern region isn't here tonight, but I know that they feel strongly about that October date. They've seen a vast reduction in complaints and conflict since they moved it to those dates. And to address the production, the lack of production that you're seeing on the cubs, I asked Clint out there if he was seeing any of that, and he said, you know, his denning data all looked good and things like that. But, you know, maybe we need to get together and see if there's specific areas we're seeing those losses in cub production or things like that. And with the restricted pursuit season, I believe you brought up the, and I want to clarify, currently we're proposing 4 resident, 1 non-resident on the LaSalle and 13 on San Juan. You would like those flush across, like 9 on each one or something like that? Or?
Yeah, just raise one.
Okay.
Okay. I guess my comment regarding what you just mentioned regarding the Book Cliffs season dates is that you may not see conflict if you have houndsmen that aren't participating because of the perceived conflict that might exist. So it might be helpful to actually get with them and find out.
Yeah, that might be part of it.
Any other comment and or motion from the rack? Craig?
Well, I would like to, I'm kind of with the last motion we made, that I would like the board to look at those dates for also the pursuit, also, and also part of the, that the Book Cliff dates match what the San Juan is doing. So I don't know if that should be in the motion or we just added it.
Sure, let's make that a motion. So your motion is
to
have the Book Cliffs season dates match the LaSalle and San Juan for
right.
Okay.
And also that the LaSalle Pursuit matches the San Juans, too. The date.
You guys are kind of jogging my memory now as you're talking about it. I did ask the Southeastern region about that. This was part of that kind of experiment that they started to do years ago. There's a hypothesis that some of the issues we get of bears coming into town, getting in trouble, maybe correlated with the hound pursuit. And so years ago, they decided to flip-flop those two units, the LaSalle and San Juan, where they give a very low number of pursuit permits and a higher one on the other one, and flip that. And they found that at that scale, it was too difficult to see if there was any difference. And so I know the Southeastern region would like to stick with the 4 and 13 for 3 years in order to really take a look at that and get through all the climatic ups and downs and see if that's really having an effect. So in their absence, I just wanted to defend their standpoint on that. But I respect your comment.
Well, my memory is that the change was made because the pursuit was happening when there were campers there. And there were people camping, and then dogs were coming through their camps. And so they changed the date to more with campers to not have conflicts with campers rather than hunters.
That could be. It was nuisance related.
Okay, so we have a motion on the table. Is that right, Craig?
Right. Let's just do the Buck Cliff.
Okay, so you're striking the LaSalle Pursuit match. Okay, so do we need a second? Okay, Matt, seconds. So the motion is to change the season dates of the Buck Cliffs to match the LaSalle and San Juan season dates. Okay. Any comment, discussion rather, on the motion? Okay, we'll call the question. All those in favor of changing the Buck Cliffs season dates to match the LaSalle and San Juan season dates, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
One, two, three. Three in favor, opposed? Nay. One, two, three. Nine. 3-9. Motion fails. Okay. Now we need another motion. Bryce?
Make a motion that we accept the proposal as presented and that we have the division look into the, you know, talk to the guys in the Southeast and see, you know, exactly what the problems and issues are, and we can address those, but accept the proposal as presented.
We have a second. Okay, second by Kevin. Discussion. Okay, we'll call the question, and that is to approve the presentation as recommended, with the comment of asking the division to look into the Buck Cliffs season dates. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimous. Okay. Next business in order is private pond rule amendments. Randy? Craig Skalgard.
My name is Craig Skalgard, and Randy had to go to a cutthroat trout meeting in Grand Junction, and I helped develop this rule, make the changes to it. So they asked me to come and present it tonight. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time. We were asked by and what this is to change is changes to the aquaculture fish stocking rule, R 657-16, and the private fish pond rule, R-657-59. We were asked by the private aquaculture people to look at this rule, to look at places where things might be changed. And the private aquaculture people provide a valuable service to us in that a lot of these ponds that are stocked, and when I was manager in this region, I did most of the pond stockings or pond inspections, and I would say probably 90% of the people or better said that they wanted these ponds so for their kids and grandkids. And we need to keep infusing youth into the fishing program. So they are important to us. They provide these fish that the state can't provide because of the private portion of it. So without them, you know, these ponds wouldn't be stocked and this need wouldn't be met. So we met with them to try to address some of their concerns. Some of their concerns were that fish cannot be stocked into privately owned ponds situated on natural stream channels. The fish cannot be stocked into privately owned ponds that lack screens, and the sterility of species requirement was not clear. The current rule intended to prevent fish stocked in privately owned ponds from interacting with fish off private land. We want to keep the fish that are in the ponds and not have them interact with fish in the wild and causing problems or interactions that might impact our native fish negatively. The private pond stocking rule is strictly to protect our native species, to keep them from being further declined or even listed. But we didn't acknowledge that there were situations where stocking ponds on natural stream channels or ponds without screens poses little threat to native fish. And so we looked into opportunities to change the rule. Eliminating rule R-657-16, aquaculture and fish stocking, and combine it with the private pond rule. And when we do this, the new title will be Private Fish Ponds, Short-Term Fishing Events, Private Fish Stocking, and Institutional Aquaculture. Both these rules have effect on private aquaculture industry. There was overlap with the rules, and combining them improves regulatory consistency. That makes it easier to follow because you only have one rule to turn to. And it streamlines the rules. The combined rule eliminated all parts that aren't essential to native fish conservation. So as we went through this process of combining the rules and making it more suitable and easy for them to follow, the first thing that we were concerned with was that of the native fish conservation and not having any problems that might cause problems there. We removed language that duplicates or corresponds with the Department of Agriculture rule. They oversee the private industry, and we didn't have to have language in there that was similar to theirs. And then the combined rule requirements are similar to other Western states. We did research to see what other states were doing and found that we're in the ballpark of what other states are around us. This is what the current rule looks like. Does the pond meet all these requirements? Not located on a natural stream channel, has screens on both the inlet and outlet. Fish species desired for stocking were permitted for that area. And if all these three were met, then the industry could stock fish there. If species sterility wasn't permitted, request of a certificate, or COR, the industry can stock after the COR was instituted, and the division didn't allow stocking to be permitted in ponds that were on natural stream channels, except for in a few situations that were grandfathered into it. If they maintained their COR, then they continued to keep that after this rule, when the rule was created. After the new changes that we'd like to do, we still have the same three issues, and if those three issues are met, then fish can be stocked. If one of these issues are not met, then they can apply for a COR, and that allows the division to go out and on site look at the pond, determine whether there would be a conflict or not. Some ponds, they might flow out into a field and never touch a flowing stream, and they don't need to be screened. There's no need for that screen. We can go out there and look at the situation, and if it's on a natural stream channel, and if a high flow event happens to wash out and put the fish into the stream, we can determine as an agency whether there would be an impact to the native fish. And if we felt like that there would be no impacts, then that they could stock on a natural stream or without screens, or even we could allow other species to be there, then a COR could be issued and they would be allowed to stock in these situations. The industry requested that we stock ponds in natural stream channels, and now we can, with this new rule, we can do that with the certificate of registration, remove pond screening requirements. Now we can do that again with the COR, and this will be after they've been visited and determined that there wouldn't be an impact, and then stock disease certified sterile salmonids into any privately owned pond. And now we can do that except for brown trout and brown trout hybrids in Washington County. There was an agreement with the recovery program down there that we wouldn't be stocking brown trout in that region to help with the recovery of endangered fish in the Virgin River down there. So the industry requested that we have some clarity on where fish can and can't be stocked. There was a little bit of gray area, you know, with our maps and then being able to get there and say, is this in the area where sterile fish are required or is it outside of that area? We've developed a web-based smartphone compatible map that they can be there at the pond, look it up on their thing and say, yep, this fish is okay here. We also made the simplification of reporting requirements that they were able to add this into their smartphone and then have it be downloaded into the database. Developed a simple online reporting tool that auto-filled a lot of the categories that they had to refill over and over and over, and now they can just auto-fill them with their information, like the hatchery name, the stalking person, all those requirements that were there. It took a lot of that out of it. The industry requested that we referred certificates of registration, and that they preferred certificates of registration to exemption certificates. We currently have what we call an exemption certificate that is filled out and prepared by the biologists in the region. And the industry said that a lot of times they would get those and they would look at them and they couldn't tell if it was written by the biologist or if somebody else had added species to the list that shouldn't have been added there. The COR is going to be a little more official coming from the office. It'll be a typewritten thing and it'll be a little bit harder for changes to be made. And so we're going to only allow CORs and do away with the exemption certificates. all existing exemption certificates will be turned into CORs, and CORs will last for 5 years. This five-year period reduces the how often the pond owner will have to apply for the COR. There won't be any lifetime. The old exemption certificates were kind of a lifetime thing, but it didn't allow the division, as we change management direction, to go back and look and make sure that the COR was in compliance with what we want to do. And then the old plan made it seem like it, or a rule made it seem like the private industry was responsible for short-term fishing events, that the certification that says that this fish was caught at this pond and didn't need a license was kind of fell on them. And so we clarified that to make sure that they didn't feel that obligation. And those are the changes.
Great, thank you. Questions from the public? Questions from the RAC?
I have one question. Where you use the smartphone technology, does that work if there's not reception?
No, it wouldn't, but some of the GPS might.
Okay. Generally, you can download a map app, and then your GPS will show you where it's
at. Yeah. Okay. It'll be downloaded prior, and so when they bring it up, it'll be there. But
okay.
But they might not have the connection to download it out of the field.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Not, we'll go to comments. I just have one comment card from Troy Justins.
Troy Justinson, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. Our membership is made up of a large amount of anglers, and they have some real concern over this, but they're comfortable with the changes you made and just hope and seek that you'll continue to watch over and protect our fisheries. You know, Utah is a greatly diversified state. It's a pretty cool state to live in with all the different things that we have, and one thing we have is a great fishery, so we support the division's recommendations on this issue. Thank you.
Okay, comments and or motion from the RAC?
Just a comment. I participated in buying fish for a little pond that we have, and when we first started doing that for our family, it was a little more difficult to get them, and most of the hoops that we jumped through really weren't necessary, and this for me, it seems like a good thing. Once we went through everything, everything was obvious that we were not in any way going to harm any kind of tributary or any other fish, and so I think that by doing this, it just simplifies it, and it makes it still protecting the resource and just making it easier. So thank you.
It definitely gives more options.
Yeah.
Any other comments, Russ?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think they put a lot of work into this, and I like the changes that they've made. I move that we recommend to the Wildlife Board that they accept the changes to the private pond rule amendments as been presented tonight.
Okay, second, Justin. Okay, the motion is to accept as presented. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor of accepting the changes as presented, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next business in order is the Aquatic Invasive Species Amendments, and Nathan Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my name is Nathan Owens. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. I'm here to present a few proposed rule changes to Rule R657-60, the Aquatic Invasive Species Rule. So to provide a little bit of context and I guess to set the stage for why we're proposing a few of these rule changes, I'd like to provide an update on where we currently stand. So Utah is fairly lucky in regards to our infested water bodies. We only have two listed water bodies within the state of Utah. Lake Powell, everyone knows that's classified as an infested water body, meaning that there is a reproducing mussel population there, several age classes. It's been that way for a few years now. Deer Creek Reservoir is listed as a suspect reservoir, meaning that we had a single water sample about 2 years ago now that showed the larval form of mussel, of quagga mussels, the veliger stage. We've done extensive sampling since, haven't found any further evidence of mussels, so we're hopeful that that was just kind of a one-time event and we can soon delist Deer Creek Reservoir and reclassify it to an undetected water. We have containment programs in place at both of these reservoirs, which basically entails we ensure that no standing water is leaving on any watercraft leaving the area, and we're watching out for any attached mussels on any watercraft equipment or anything that's being transported out as well. 2016 was kind of an unusual year for us. Up until this point, all the focus had been on making sure that no standing water was leaving the area. 2016 provided us with a few more challenges. We ended up finding roughly 50 boats season-wide that had mussels attached to some extent or another. And to provide some perspective on that, in all of 2015, we had less than 15 boats. So things have significantly ramped up just in the last year. And that has basically kind of encouraged us to think outside the box and how we want this program to look in the future and how to best deal with some of these changing conditions and challenges that we're starting to see. So the first proposed rule change, we would like to institute a mandatory dry time requirement in addition to a professional decontamination for all boats found to have mussels attached. Under our current rule, if a boat pulls out of Lake Powell and has mussels attached to it, even if it could be 100 mussels, that boat could receive a 1 or 2 hour decontamination, leave, and immediately launch up here, say at Jordanelle, the same day. We don't really have much authority to stop them at that point. Our recent work down at our I-15 port of entry station has shown that this is probably not the best approach. We've seen a number of boats coming from Lake Mead in the lower Colorado system with mussels attached, and after a professional decontamination was performed in Nevada, we also found mussels and could not actually verify that those mussels were dead. So that boat could have potentially been carrying live mussels after a professional decontamination, taking them to a Utah reservoir. We don't feel that that's acceptable, and that's not a risk we're willing to take. Another big point of focus for this rule change is, again, there's been a lot of focus on standing water and veligers. While that's true, they pose a significant risk. The fact is, even if you have veligers in a water column within a reservoir, those veligers have to settle out within 12 to 18 inches of one another as they start to grow in order to successfully reproduce. If you're talking about adult mussels attached to a boat that are introduced into a reservoir, you are essentially talking about a whole new colony ready to start reproducing as soon as they hit the water. Again, not a risk we would like to take. In terms of what the dry time would be, we are recommending that this dry time would coincide with the seasonal dry time requirement we currently have in place. So in the summer, that's 7 days. In the fall and the spring months, those are 18 days. And in the winter, that's 30 days. I want to emphasize that this proposed rule change would likely only affect those boats that have been slipped or moored in some of these infested water bodies for an extended period of time. So we're talking several weeks, if not months. Your normal weekend warrior that heads down to Lake Powell for a 3 or 4 day vacation, they are not going to be affected by this rule change, at least not for the foreseeable future. The second rule change we would like to propose, we'd like to amend a current rule change we already have in place. As of right now, the way the rule reads, any boat leaving a listed reservoir must be completely drained of all water before leaving the immediate area. We would like to add to that and require that all of those boats be transported with any drain plugs or any other devices that could retain water outside that boat. The reason for this is that we have technicians on the ramps at Lake Powell and Deer Creek Reservoir, and they do a great job of making sure that these boats are drained of water. They make sure all drain plugs are removed and outdrives are lowered and everything is drained out. The problem is we also periodically perform administrative checkpoints down the road on some of these highways coming out of Lake Powell. And we've started to see that even those boats that we thought were completely drained of water, as soon as you put them on the trailer and start driving them down the highway, things shift around. You know, water that was retained in there all of a sudden becomes accessible. We pull that plug again, sometimes up to a gallon of water comes out. When you're talking a gallon of water with some of these veliger densities, you're talking sometimes several tens of thousands of veligers that could be in that single gallon of water. Again, we don't feel like that's a risk we're willing to take, and this is a small thing to ask for a boater when they're coming out of an infested water. We will eventually move to make this, propose to make this mandatory for all boats coming and traveling within the state of Utah, but right now we're focusing on those coming from infested water bodies. And the last point I'd like to make about this is something the entire Western U.S. is pursuing to some extent in the next year. We have, I'd say, probably 6 to 8 of the 19 Western states trying to put something like this on the books this year. The rest are following suit next year. So this is another attempt to standardize things and remain consistent within the Western U.S. The third proposed rule change, it's mostly a housekeeping issue. The state of Colorado is currently listed out as an infested region under our rule. Colorado is fairly similar to Utah in that back in 2007, 2008, they had a series of 4 reservoirs show evidence of quagga mussel veligers. We had Red Fleet and Electric Lake show evidence as well. Like Red Fleet and Electric Lake, no testing since has shown any evidence of mussels. Those have subsequently been delisted. The last remaining reservoir listed in Colorado is Pueblo Reservoir. Again, no evidence of mussel since 2011. As of probably January, that will be delisted in Colorado, so they will no longer have any classified water bodies within their state. We feel like Colorado boats don't pose any significantly more risk to Utah than Utah boaters, and would like to remove Colorado from that list. And that's essentially saying that we do not want Colorado to treat every Utah boater as having been to Lake Powell. The fourth and final rule change we're proposing would just include some quarantine language under rule R657-60-11, which pertains to conveyance or equipment detainment. This would essentially allow our Division of Wildlife Resource officers the ability to quarantine watercraft, especially those watercraft found to have attached mussels, without having to take possession of that watercraft from the boat owner. This rule, we're already granted this authority under statute. This is just to more clarify it within the rule. We are currently doing this. We've had probably a handful of instances this last year where we've had our officers basically contact someone with a mussel-encrusted boat and say, okay, we've provided you with a professional decontamination. Now I'm going to need to have you take that back to your place of residence, and we're going to have to basically put a tag on that boat, making sure that boat does not leave your garage until that required dry time is met. So we are currently doing this, and it's basically another step to help our officers. And with that, if anyone would like a muscle tea, we could probably arrange that, but you will need a COR.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the public regarding the presentation? Questions from the RAC? Kevin?
In an inboard outboard, there's a significant amount of water that's retained in the block and the manifolds. How do you feel about that? That's water that you can't drain out of the bilge.
Yeah, the way the rule reads, it's to the extent reasonable. Basically, whatever you can do without having to fully winterize your boat. For the most part, when water is going through a block or going through an engine, it's going to heat up to some extent. Veligers are pretty delicate. Obviously, no adult mussels would be found in there, but veligers could survive in any retained water. Again, they're pretty delicate, and if you put a dry time on there of any, probably more than just a few days, you're going to kill any veligers that are in there too. So while that does pose a risk, it's fairly low on our priority scale. We're mostly concerned about the gallons of water that may be residing in ballast tanks that haven't been fully drained, or now in this new phase, any adult mussels that may be hiding within engine compartments that we don't have ready access to.
Okay. Yes. So apart from being a sportsman, I spend a lot of time at Lake Powell, usually up to 3 weeks a year. The checkpoints, the different things that go on there are can be very frustrating. A lot of people are leaving the lake. I dare say if I watch 10 boats leave the lake, two of them are stopped and washed. I'm hoping that there's something else in the place to try to make it an easier thing. I think people that are sportsmen and want to protect the waterways and things are more likely to stop, but a lot of the crowd there, they're not too worried about the mussel. They want to get out of the lake and get home as quick as possible. So a question I just have is, what kind of authority do you have? You know, you talked about quarantining a boat. Is there a bite behind it? Is there things going on to try to enforce this?
Absolutely. We do have a law enforcement officer here that specializes in this, so we can definitely call him up as well. But like I mentioned, we have quarantined at least a handful of boats this last year that we had to basically say that boat cannot leave your garage for this amount of time. We've also started any boat with attached mussels, we started directing to a private business for decontamination. And that is a paid service now. Some of these boats that do have attached mussels, decontamination may take two individuals, you know, up to 12 or 14 hours in some cases, and we don't have the resources to concentrate on one boat for that amount of time. We have written citations. Our officers have written citations at our check stations for any residual water in, you know, outdrives, in ballast tanks, anything like that, which is another reason why this plug rule would be very important. Mm-hmm. So there is a bite to it. We have written, I don't know what the number is, I'd say probably 20 to 30 citations this last season for residual water leaving the area.
Just watching the number of people that leave the water at one time without building an enormous facility that boats can come up in there to channel them there and make it it's never going to be a pleasurable experience, but at least to make it to where you're not there for literally 2 hours, you know, with your kids screaming. And this is coming from experience. You're trying to leave the lake, people lined up. If we want to protect it, I think it's going to require a lot more law enforcement and a better plan than what's taken place. And you've probably witnessed that. People are leaving at night just to avoid this. You know, can leave the lake at night and no one's there to do anything.
I agree. We are thinking outside the box on this. We are looking at the potential for 24/7 ramp coverage at Lake Powell this next year. Obviously, that requires a great deal of funding. We are actually speaking with a business out of Colorado to look at the potential for using dip tanks for decontamination. That has never been done before, and we'd like to be the first to see if that will actually work. And that would cut down the decontamination time for, say, you know, a wakeboard boat that may take 45 minutes. That would cut it down to probably about 2 to 3 minutes. So we're looking at other options, but it's a complicated problem and it's a huge challenge.
A very huge challenge, yes. Thank you for your work and working on it.
Any other questions from the rec?
One question. So you're going to make the drain plug this year out of Lake Powell. but you're wanting to do it next year and other states are wanting to do it next year, why not just start right now and just do it statewide? And because, I mean, people are going to start getting confused. Just make it a rule and make them do it.
We would like that. The issue is our authority is a little bit muddy in this area when it comes to requiring that of all boats, even boats not coming from an infested water body. Our authority basically comes from being able to regulate the transport of quagga or zebra mussels. So we're exploring options. We're exploring working with state parks and maybe make that happen. Some of the other states don't have that issue because they're responsible for regulating boating overall. So we're looking at that, but that's probably, again, maybe a year down the road or so.
Okay. Any other questions?
I just have one quick one. Besides getting the citation, which would be a criminal action if somebody was to get cited for the things that you mentioned, does the state ever consider doing any civil penalties on people who transport the mussels? There's got to be a huge cost to the state when a body of water gets infested. I'm just looking at the penalty phase and what could happen and make people a little more willing to cooperate than just a citation.
Yeah, that's a great question. I will say yes. I don't know. I can't really elaborate on that. Maybe one of our law enforcement officers can. They have a better background in that area. This is Lieutenant Scott Dalebout. He's kind of an AIS logistics coordinator with us.
Good evening. That's a great question. We have had civil penalties. The last one we did was, I think, about 2 years ago, where they actually had live mussels on it. They tried to sneak it through. We actually quarantined their boat for 40-something days, and they were assessed, I think it was about $5,000, to cover the cost of the personnel and the equipment we had to purchase to thoroughly decontaminate their boat.
You guys need to make that more public so people understand what
could
happen.
We're getting better at that, too. This problem is continually evolving, mm-hmm. so we have to evolve the rules and laws to go with it, and our law enforcement, increase our capacity as well as everything else. It's just evolving. We just want to make it evolve slower, as slow as possible to save the millions of dollars each year from the damage to our infrastructure. So you're absolutely right.
Okay, appreciate it.
That was a great question. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, we don't have any comment cards from the public. Anybody? Okay, comments and or motion from the RAC.
I'll make a motion we accept the rules as presented.
Okay, we have a second?
Second.
Second, Bryce. Okay, discussion. Seeing none, we'll call the question. Question on the table is to accept the rule amendments as presented. All in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. Okay, no. Yep. Motion passes unanimous. Last order of business is the dedicated hunter rule amendments, R657-38 by Brian Christensen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and RAC members and those attending. My name is Brian Christensen. I am the dedicated hunter, statewide coordinator, and volunteer services. Today, I brought before you some proposed rule changes to the dedicated hunter program. For those maybe not as familiar with what this program is, it's a general season deer hunting opportunity that allows participants that join this program the ability to hunt 3 years in a row for general season deer in exchange for 32 hours of of division approved service and a training course for educational reasons, and then they also agree to only harvest two deer in a 3 year time frame. So it's been a great program. It's generated a lot of service for wildlife and wildlife habitat and wildlife recreation in general. The program has been running for many years. Our last major change was during the 2011-2012 timeframe when we went from regional hunting to unit-based hunting. Since then, we've had several years now to run those changes and run the program, and we found a few things basically that could be improved. Some of it's just grammatical within the rule, and some of it is a little bit more structural. I've mentioned this is the background on the program. Right now we have approximately 8,000 participants in the program. Our main purposes, again today, are to update some of the wording. Some of that will mirror existing statute and other administrative rules and correlate within the rule itself. We're going to clarify and simplify some things, and then we're going to hopefully address some common requests we've had from participants that are actually in the program. With clarification, we have a need to put some language in our rule that talks about when a hunting or combination license is required. By statute, if you're issued a big game permit, you have to have a combo or hunting license. What we've done is with this change, made it the same as all other big game permits. So if you apply for it, you got to have the license. When the permit gets issued later on, in May or June, that first year, we're not going to look again to see if you had it, because we know you had it to begin with. The second and third year, when we issue permits, we'll check to see if you have a combo or hunting license as statute requires. So just a little technical wording that we needed within the rule. We also added when hunters are in the field, in the archery season, they need to use archery equipment. When they're in the muzzleloader season, they need to use muzzleloaders, and so on. That hadn't been in the rule before. It was basically assumed as part of the seasons and the boundaries. Then the last thing here for clarification was our wildlife conservation and ethics course. We had always intended that once you join the program, that's an appropriate time to take this educational course, and not necessarily before. And so we've added that clarification that once you join, then you can take this training course. And we do update that from time to time. So the next thing with simplification would be to allow residents the option of purchasing all 32 hours. The current rule allows non-residents to do that, but not residents. Residents were only allowed to purchase 24 of the 32. What we found in the past is that the existing rule would allow residents to purchase 24 hours if they desired, rather than performing the service, and then they could donate requested material goods to the division for their other 8 hours. So to them, it was really the same. It's been running that way for several years. So this just kind of cleans it up and makes it even, makes it the same privilege for both residents and non-residents. We want to consolidate within the rule all of the suspension provisions. We had two or three different sections that talked about those things, and we've pushed them all to the back. Anything we've removed was already covered within statute. And then this last part, simplification for military. We have quite a few military personnel that are participants in the program, and they never know when they're going to be deployed. And so what we've had in the past was a rule that offered them a variety of options, service credit, extensions, and a variety of things. But it didn't take care of all situations. It was a little too broad. So what we've done here is cleaned it up a little bit, hopefully. And what it says now is if they're deployed or mobilized for a 3-month consecutive time frame within the hunt year, they can request to just not hunt that year, and we'll add 1 year to their COR, their 3-year time frame. So it just kind of pushes it forward a little bit. We've talked to military, and they felt that the 3-month time frame really disrupts their life for that year, and they really look forward to this change. It also would offer an extension if they were deployed during the hunt season. So some of them will get their service hours done. They'll be anticipating the August hunt, and then they'll find out they're being deployed for August or September or October. This allows them that flexibility to add on a year that they were able to miss. For the administrative side, we have had several requests each year from dedicated hunters that draw a limited entry deer permit. They get lucky in the drawing and they pick that permit. And the current rule basically says that if you get one of those permits, you just ate your dedicated hunter year. So you get 2 years now instead of three. Some have been okay with that, and some have requested that we look at a possible extension in that situation. It's a very small number each year, so we felt like it was appropriate to allow them that option, that if they do draw from the big game drawing only, or if they accept one of our poaching reported rewards permits for limited entry deer, that they have the option to extend 1 year. They still have all the same requirements, and everything else stays the same. It just makes it so they don't lose one of their 3 years. The modification of signature requirement here, the current rule requires every dedicated hunter to sign a piece of paper that is their certificate of registration. That piece of paper is probably becoming something of the past with our electronic world progressing. We've changed this to state that you need to sign something as required by the division, and that may be an electronic signature in the future, but it gives us more flexibility with how we distribute CORs. It also will speed up our process from when you draw to when you get your information by probably a month is how much better that could end up being. The service hour exemption, we currently have in our rule a provision that allows a dedicated hunter participant that goes off to college for a year or participates with a religious endeavor that takes them away for at least a 1 year period, the opportunity to have their hours, their service hours waived for that year. They don't get to hunt that year, but they don't have to do their requirements. What we've found over the past few years is, although the intent was to relieve some of those folks of a burden that they can't fulfill because they're out of state or they're out of the country, what we found is it really didn't help that many. The rule stated they had to be gone for a minimum period of a year. Most of these folks leave in July, and hunting season is that next few months, and they're not gone the full 1 year period. So what we've done is we've just taken that whole section out of our rule, and this next section, what it does is it provides more flexibility for what I call life situations, and this could be school or religious stuff or divorce or injuries. Life changes that take you away from your intent to participate in the program. And it makes it easier to withdraw and start over at another time. So our current rule says that if you have zero permits issued during your 3-year time frame, you can withdraw by signing a little piece of paper and just be free and clear and go on with life. If you had one permit issued, we'd require that you had 10 hours of service done first. You sign the piece of paper and you can withdraw and be free and clear. But that was it. Those are the only two options, unless you get injured or something worse. So this new recommendation, what it does is it allows somebody in a similar situation, zero permits issued, can surrender or withdraw from the program at any time. And they don't need any hours done. We can just let them out. If it's one permit that they've had, 11 hours. And we've upped that just by 1 hour to try to get closer to the third. One year is a third of the hours. If they've had two permits issued, now we would require them to have 22 hours of service done, being roughly two-thirds of the total requirement, and then they could withdraw and leave. And this happens often enough that this would relieve quite a few people that leave the state or have, you know, life situations of the burden of having to complete their program. It also frees up that COR that next year for somebody else to start up and utilize. The big hitch with this, though, is that nobody will be able to surrender outside of the injury or illness circumstances if they've harvested two deer. If you've got your two of the deer in the 3 years, you're in it for the long haul. You got to finish up. So that's the biggest change. Last little note on here is that the service hours, in case they by chance did surrender, let's say they had zero permits issued during their 3 years, and they had done some service, 8 or 10 or 20 hours, we wouldn't forward those hours into a future COR. That's everything they've done is good just for that 3 year time frame they had. We don't push it to later dates or later enrollments. And that's what I have for you.
Great, thank you. Questions from the public regarding the presentation? Questions from the RAC? Yeah. Matt.
What are you currently charging for service hours?
Right now we've rated each hour at $20.
Is it the same for resident versus non-resident?
Yes, yep, same value.
I have a question regarding the permits. As far as you declare once you've received the notice that you've drawn, you've declared what permit you would like. Just for instance, this year I had a unit 4, 5, and 6. I draw a permit on the LaSalle's, and I was like, golly, it'd have been nice to be able to hunt deer while I'm hunting bear down here. Is there any, what are the consequences or what are the things behind not being able to declare like 1 year, one unit or another? Or is there any?
You might have to clarify some question for me there.
The thing is, 1 year, you know, once you say you drew the dedicated hunter, you have to tell them at that time, if I understand, what unit you will be hunting, and mm-hmm. that's where you will get your permit for the next 3 years.
Right.
Is there any way, just with the draw systems, you have a family member that ends up drawing another one or a hunting partner. Is there any way to change it from 1 year to the next?
Mm-hmm. No, right now.
Is there a reason why that's not looked
yes,
into?
Yes, there is. And I get that. That's probably the biggest question I get each year, at least into my office, is, you know, how can I change my unit if after the first year I want to be somewhere else? The reason we can't change it, and that used to be possible. When we hunted regionally, you could change, you know, to whatever region you wanted from year to year. When we changed from unit to unit hunting, we created a whole new system. And dedicated hunter became part of the big game drawing. Beforehand, it was done in December. And so we knew well in advance of the big game application period and the drawing where each dedicated hunter was going to be. But now that it's part, you know, it's intertwined with the way that the big game drawing runs. And so as soon as a dedicated hunter permit is drawn, it pulls three permits out, basically, for the next 3 years, so one permit for each year, out of those quotas, sets it aside for that unit. And it's got to stay that way, mostly because the dedicated hunter opportunities, the quota that we allow for each unit, is tied to a percentage of the quota per year. So it gets a little complicated. If we have, you know, 100 hunting permits on one unit, and that means we have 15 dedicated hunters that can be in there. If that gets filled up this year, we don't have somewhere for somebody else to just say, I want to switch over to that unit. There are, those other units are at capacity as far as what we're allowed to issue. So it gets a little complicated with other units being full. There's no additional permits for you to switch to. It also makes it easier just to stay with it. My biggest recommendation with applications is if you have family members that you want to hunt with, don't put more than one choice on your application. Make sure everybody has the same single choice, and then you'll know that you won't get split up.
That was for one reason that I've contemplated withdrawing from the dedicated hunter, because I kind of feel like the unit that I have tagged for the next 2 years isn't where I want to be, and so...
Yeah,
I think it's a definite downside to it in some ways.
And that's definitely one of the reasons why we've looked at this withdraw option. I do get several calls a year from somebody that draws, finds out their kids drew somewhere else. Says, I can't hunt both places. I need out. And this lets somebody out their first year easy. After one tag, it's still fairly easy. After two tags, they can still get out. So there's at least more options now than you had before you're pretty much stuck with it.
Craig, did you have a question?
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. Since the hunting went from regions to units, mm-hmm. has dedicated hunter numbers gone up or down, or has it stayed about the same? Or
Originally it went down. We were at 10,000 back when we were hunting regionally. It dropped down just above 4,000. And then we are now, just in the past couple of years, we've started gaining. We're at just under 8,000, and there's anticipation that we will increase next year by quite a bit.
Okay, my second question, in the latest elk management plan,
mm-hmm. right.
they do have an option for dedicated hunter, and one of the hurdles is probably that I've heard is a division can't provide service hours or can't manage the service hours that would be required. And my question is, would you rather have the service hours or would you rather have the money?
I'm going to say we'd rather have the service.
Okay.
The project service is far more valuable. I mean, the money's nice because it helps fund projects. It helps fund employees that run these programs. It does good things. But from the Dedicated Hunter program side, we prefer the service over the money any day. You mentioned the elk option. Yes, there is definitely a concern if we started a brand new program for Dedicated Hunter elk, there is some concern that we may not be able to provide the number of quality projects with two groups competing for the same kinds of project, because deer and elk live in the same places. We would try to provide as many as possible, but yeah, there's some concern on quantity and quality. And within the elk management plan, it asks us to review and see if it's a viable, feasible program to start. I can tell you that we've talked it out pretty good, and I'm one of those that would be a proponent of it. I've always wanted to see that, and the more I look at it, we asked the question, what are we after? Is it additional opportunities for service, or is it additional opportunities in the field? And if that's what we're really after, it may make as much or more sense to just have a new permit where it offers more season time, not necessarily tied to service.
Okay.
So that's another option we're exploring, but it's not dead in the water yet as far as that elk management plan recommendation. Or suggestion.
I worked with Bryce on one of the projects. You might want his money over his service.
Unless he brings his son.
Yeah, if he brings Ben, he's okay. If he brings his son.
Any other questions? What percentage of the dedicated hunter actually buy out their hours rather than?
I have that.
Just ballpark. I'm just curious.
If I remember right, it's about 18% of the hours, 15 to 18% of the hours, and that's this last year. That was higher than any prior year. Before that, we were probably looking more like 8 to 10%. Right now we're in, we need one more year and we will have had everybody that's been in the program, you know, back when it was 40 hours and a few years ago before we switched over to this opportunity. Like now, if you join the program, that first year you don't have to do any service. The second year you have to have 16 hours. And so we're seeing now a full wave of people that have been in the program for their first, second, and third years and starting over again to where they've learned, don't wait till your second year to do service. And so we've had these big rushes in August of purchased service hours where I think next year enough people will have learned to do at least a little bit their first year just to make it easier. That I don't know that we'll see that high of a level anymore.
Okay, any other questions? Comments from the public? I don't have any cards, but welcome to comment. Comments and or motion from the rack. Yeah, Kevin.
I would make a motion that we accept the recommendations with a look at or to double the fee for out of residence to buy their hours.
Okay, do I have a second? Okay, John seconds. Discussion.
I'm a non-resident in a lot of other states that I would not like that, but that's my opinion.
Well, just to it becomes a money thing again, where someone can just buy the right to be in that program, and like you said, the service hours are more important, and are probably more beneficial to the whole process than the money, and I think there ought to be a difference in the purchase of those hours by a non-resident versus a resident. I just think that a resident should get some consideration.
Did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I would like the chance to do that. I saw maybe some others that wanted to say something about that. So. Non-residents right now are paying over $1,000 for a COR, where a resident adult pays $195. So they're already being hit pretty good just to join. I think we'd be happy to look at your request. What it may boil down to, though, is more of an auditing standpoint for value. A service hour is rated, and not everybody knows this out in the field as you're digging fences and stretching wire and doing all the great things out there, planting bitter brush and everything else. Every service hour is rated by the type of service it is. If you're helping out in an office, it's one value. If you're helping out in the field, it's another. If it's a professional service, it's rated at another, and we record them that way. So it may boil down to some fiscal rules that say, one man's hour, one person's hour, can't be unequivalent to another person's equal service hour, as far as their value. Now, purchasing, I'm not sure if that's going to be the same, but your service and my service, dependent, no matter who we are, is looked at the same way value-wise from a federal standpoint and a state standpoint. So there may be a hiccup there, but be happy to look at it.
Are there very many non-resident? I'd be curious if there is.
I don't have an actual number for you today, because I'm not sure. I didn't look at 2016. There are a few dozen, for sure, so maybe 30 or 40 that do it. Some of those actually plan their projects for the week before their hunt. They call us well in advance. They come out, they work for a week, and then they go hunting. Others just pay it. Yeah.
You know, and I would... I would agree that a service hour is equal to a service hour, but sitting in your easy chair in Arizona with a big, big bank account, they ought to pay a little more for their service hours if they're going to buy them. Just my opinion.
Bryce.
I think paying $1,000 for the COR is, I mean, way enough. I don't think you should penalize them. I mean, they're paying $1,000 for the COR, plus they're paying X amount for the deer tag every year.
That's, well, they get, no. The deer tag's free after
okay.
that, but
yeah.
their non-resident license has to be maintained.
Well, I still think that $1,000 versus the, you know, what we pay is more than compensation. I'd hate to ding them anymore, because then, you know, like you say, like Justin said, you know, we're non-residents in a lot of states, and it could get... We could return the favor.
You guys are getting soft.
Any other comments? Non-residents still have to go through the training course, the ethics piece as
yeah,
well. That's online,
all
I guess.
The requirements identical.
That's
yeah.
online. They're doing mm-hmm. that online.
Correct.
Any other comments or questions on the motion? Okay, we'll call the motion, the question. The motion is to accept the rule amendments as presented, but to double the fee for non-residents. All those in favor signify by saying aye and raise your hand. Opposed? Okay, motion fails. Next motion. Yeah.
I motion we accept the change proposed by the division and accept it as the way they have it, he stated. As presented, excuse me.
Thank you. We have a second. Matt? Discussion? Okay, seeing none, we'll call the question. The motion on the table is to accept the rule amendments as presented. All in favor signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. All right, thank you. So that is the final item on the agenda for tonight. I would remind everybody that we're not meeting again until March, so we have a long Christmas break. Without objection, we'll call the meeting adjourned. Seeing none, the meeting is adjourned. Have a good Christmas.